people as young as 40 years old will be eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine in Miami-Dade County soon. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. A lot more people will be able to get vaccinated in Miami-Dade County a week from Monday. The county mayor announced people 40 years old and older can get doses, including those without any underlying conditions. A Delray Beach nursing home is the target of a COVID-19 lawsuit. The children of a resident who died from the virus say the facility did not do enough to protect patients from the germ. The suit comes as Florida lawmakers move to limit the legal liability healthcare providers and others may face. And two arrests in the case of a straw political candidate in Miami-Dade County, including a former state senator accused of bankrolling the alleged scheme. Our program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public media. You may continue to make your pledge during our program. Thanks for your support. On Monday, the state of Florida will allow people as young as 50 years old to get a COVID-19 vaccination. A week from Monday, people as young as 40 will be able to get doses in Miami-Dade County. Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava made that announcement Friday morning. It goes beyond the easier rules the state has announced so far. We spoke with the Miami-Dade County Mayor earlier today. Madam Mayor, welcome back to WLRN. So when will this age eligibility down to 40 years old take effect?
It will be next Monday. So not this coming, but the following, because we want to give notice to people to sign up for appointments on our pre-registration.
What are the new rules for people who are 40 and older?
They just have to be 40 and older. That's it.
Any county residency required?
Well, under the current rules, it's all Florida residents. So, yes, if you have proof that you reside in Florida, you will be eligible.
The rules you refer to there are the state rules. The state rules also go down to 50 years old beginning this coming Monday. You're going down to 40 on March 29th. Any concern about easing eligibility in Dade County ahead of state rules?
You know, we know that everybody wants everyone to get the vaccine, and it's just a matter of these incremental steps. By May 1, the president has said all ages should be eligible, and that's, you know, a little more than a month away. And we've already seen Orlando take this step forward. So we think we're well within the cadence, they call it, of moving gradually downward. And it's based on both supply and demand. If we are going to lose these federal FEMA sites, we're going to be asking the federal government to please leave the vaccine behind for us and we can administer it. We want to get these shots in arms.
Losing the FEMA sites, all expectations are beginning sometime next week. Those FEMA sites will be allocating just second doses and will no longer be distributing any first doses. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. That is what we've heard.
And so the eligibility that you announced today on this Friday down to 40 years old in Dade County on March 29th, where will those rules be in place?
Well, they'll be posted on our website, miamidade.gov/vaccine. And we will be taking that information on our pre-registration site and alerting people as to the availability.
Which distribution sites will be using those rules to decide who's eligible?
Yeah, so we run as a county a few sites. We have the Tropical Park, the zoo. We may consider going back to Miami-Dade College North, which was our site before we let the federal government come in and do their big outreach there. We also are doing some ambulatory sites. We've been circulating around the county based on the vulnerability index and rotating to all the county commission districts. So wherever the county is administering vaccines, we will have the new eligibility.
I suppose what's important here to specify is that it is county sites that will be operating under the rules that you announced today, not state-supplied sites, not FEMA sites, not pharmacies necessarily either, correct?
Yes, and it is so very confusing, which I really regret. So we try to provide all that information in one stop at miamidade.gov/vaccine so that you can see the different rules for each of the sites. But just to be clear, the vaccine that we're getting is an allocation that comes weekly from the state, but it is operated by our county staff as compared to the state sites, which are operated by state staff, and the federal sites, which had the support as well of the federal government.
You mentioned the registration online. Will appointments be necessary at these county sites with the younger age eligibility?
Yes. For now, all county sites take by appointment. We have not had just open walk-up at our county. We do have this pre-registration site. We have about 200,000 people in that system, and they are putting, it's all ages and all categories. And so whenever we open up to a new category or by age, we reach out to everyone in that category to let them know that we have a vaccines available for the coming week.
So those folks who have pre-registered with Miami-Dade County could expect to receive an email or a phone call in the next few days?
Yes, I don't know. It'll probably be next week that they get it, because right now we're working on appointments for next week.
You also have announced that you expect to open up to all eligible ages by the middle of April. What gives you that kind of clarity on the calendar?
Yeah, so it would be by increments of 10 years every week. This is exactly what I proposed to the governor in a letter. And of course, he responded by opening up to age 50 this coming week. So we're on par with the state eligibility for this coming week. And let's see what happens beyond. I mean, again, we're getting down to May 1st, universal eligibility for all adults. And we wanted to continue the stepwise approach to get to that point by May 1st.
Any additional outreach to underserved communities as part of this easing of age eligibility on the part of the county you announced today?
Yes, we have a great outreach team. In effect, it's called VACS Now, V-A-C-S, and it's a team of county employees as well as nonprofits and others that are working with us to get the word out. We are going to those neighborhoods that are most vulnerable, that might not otherwise know about the appointments or be able to access them. So we're making sure to address the concerns about equity in vaccination.
Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava. Madam Mayor, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Still to come on our program, a Palm Beach County nursing home is sued over COVID-19 as lawmakers move to limit the liability of companies, including nursing homes. It's still ahead. We're back on a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. You can continue to make your donations throughout our program. Almost 11,000 people living in long-term care facilities in Florida have died from complications from COVID-19. This is according to State Health Department's latest data. Almost 100 workers at those facilities statewide have died as well. Florida lawmakers are moving to pass legislation that would grant long-term care facilities and other health care providers like doctors and hospitals liability protections for COVID-related lawsuits. That legislation also includes other businesses. The state Senate President Wilton Simpson has called the protections a priority.
Our frontline healthcare workers have had to make very important decisions in the midst of rapidly changing guidance and protocols. We must do everything we can to protect these heroes. Businesses across Florida have also suffered greatly and are doing the best they can to safely reopen during a period of extreme uncertainty.
In South Florida, at least two COVID-related lawsuits have made headlines. The first is against grocery store chain Publix in the death of a Miami Beach deli worker. The second was filed last week by the family of Sarah Schleider. She was 81 years old, living at the Grand Villa of Delray East in Palm Beach County when she contracted the virus during an outbreak at the facility in May of last year. She died a month later. Spencer Coovan is an attorney with the law firm representing her family. He joins us now. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup, Spencer. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on the show.
Yeah. Families of long-term care facility residents were barred from visiting residents for much of the pandemic last year to prevent the spread of the virus. How did Sarah Schleider's family learn about the COVID outbreak at the facility at the Grand Villa of Delray East?
So I think it's important to just remember that the timing of everything that happened here, Ms. Schleider was in the memory care unit of the facility, which means she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and had been there for some time and was actually in pretty good shape. She was healthy except for her Alzheimer's, and her family would visit her on a daily basis. Her daughter lived here locally in South Florida. Her son lived up in New York, but would come down and visit periodically when he could. When COVID-19 hit and everything got shut down in March, the facility assured the family that their mother would be taken care of. And in fact, the family, the daughter and son, asked the facility if they should take their mother out and care for her privately at their home. And they said no, that she would actually be safer with them. So once the lockdown occurred, they had no contact. And eventually, they weren't even allowing phone calls in and out of the facility. So at some point, they repeatedly called and asked for the administrator, got no calls back. And then her son started calling the lines that he had, the numbers he had for the facility, and just started punching numbers. He eventually got a cook, a line cook at the facility, who picked up the phone. And he was the first to advise him that sadly there was now a massive outbreak going on at the facility, that 40 some odd staff and patients had been contracted COVID and 10 had already died.
And when was this?
This was only 3 months into the outbreak.
So
they hadn't heard
May
from anyone
in
a while. Correct. Correct. Right. This was in approximately June of last year.
Right. And so that was the first indication that your client's family knew about an infection at the facility that was caring for their mother.
Correct. Correct. They did not learn about any of the conditions or problems there at the facility from anyone in administration. They learned this from a cook.
While visitations were barred by state executive order, what reason did the facility give you for no phone calls?
Well, they said, obviously, they were dealing with an emergency, which we fully comprehend and appreciate. But then ultimately, when the Agency for Healthcare Administration, a state agency, conducted its investigation, we found out the full breadth of the problems that were going on at this particular facility. And now we understand why there were no calls. They were having a massive outbreak.
The agency you referred to there, ACHA, is what it's called for the acronym, Agency for Healthcare
Correct.
Administration, the chief state regulatory agency for healthcare. It did investigate this facility a month after the outbreak that's mentioned in your lawsuit. The final order of that investigation was actually issued. It's stamped today, March 19th, 2021. And Grand Villa agreed to pay a $1,000 fine. The facility said to WLRN today, according to the settlement, quote, ACHA only determined that Grand Villa failed to properly document COVID-specific training at the time it occurred. The statement went on from Grand Villa saying, we believe it's important to take this information from the state into consideration when evaluating the claims made by the family last week. This is refers to the lawsuit that you filed last week to Grand Villa. What's your response to that statement?
Well, it's sad, but unfortunately, state agencies that are assigned
to be...
Well, no, it's flatly not accurate. The state agency investigator went into the facility and with their own eyes... And they documented by photographic evidence the fact that they were mixing COVID laundry, in other words, laundry from patients that had been diagnosed with COVID, with clean linens. They documented cleaning units and mops and buckets from COVID patients into other rooms that patients that were did not have COVID. They documented patients walking around without masks, staff walking around without masks. This was all documented in photographic evidence.
That may be true, but the state agency responsible for regulating these facilities has settled to say that it was a training failure.
Well, at the end of the day, a training failure is still negligence. In other words, these facilities had access to the training available. They were told what they needed to do and how they needed to conduct their activities, and they didn't do it.
But is it gross negligence? Is it that legal standard, that extreme indifference, reckless disregard that's necessary for that gross negligence standard to be proven in court?
And that really is the question. With this new Senate bill that they're trying to ram through Congress now so that the governor will sign it, basically what they're doing is they're taking away the rights of Florida citizens to judge facilities on the merits of the case. We trust jurors. We trust citizens of this state to look at the facts and look at the evidence and deem what they figure is negligence, falling below an acceptable standard of care. They shouldn't be raising the bar in a circumstance where citizens of this state can be sitting in judgment on these issues. And
I want to ask you, Spencer, I want to ask you more about that legislation and the potential impact on the lawsuit. But back to the specifics around the suit that you alleged with the family of this patient, this resident of the nursing home in Palm Beach County. With this settlement now that has been agreed to by the state regulatory agency for healthcare and the facility, does that make your case that much harder? The facility, according to the state, was faulted for training failures and has agreed to pay this $1,000 fine. You're alleging, you know, much more significant negligence.
Correct. I mean, ultimately, our case is about the death of Sarah Schleider. And it was the unnecessary death of Sarah Schleider. The state agency wasn't looking at the value of Ms. Schleider's life when they decided that they were going to resolve a training issue for $1,000. And frankly, what it does is it points out the ineffectiveness of the state enforcement agency. They can only do certain things, and there are only certain maximum penalties that they can assess.
Prior to today, we also reached out to Grand Villa that issued this statement to us. We're reviewing the allegations made because we take any allegations, no matter the severity, very seriously. Part of our commitment to our residents and family members is open communications, so we look forward to being able to fully address these claims as soon as we have enough information to do so. Have you had any contact with the facility or its operator?
At this point, no. We instituted what's called a pre-suit investigation with the facility, and the complaint has been filed, as you've reported, and it's been served on the facility. They will have 20 days before they respond to our complaint formally in court.
We are speaking with Spencer Coovan, attorney for the law firm that's representing Sarah Schleider's family. She was a resident of a long-term care facility in Palm Beach County. She contracted COVID-19. She died in June. The lawsuit claims negligence on the part of the facility. The facility says it's reviewing the allegations. Spencer, we spoke about the environment here with the pending legislation in Florida, this liability legislation granting protections to businesses and healthcare providers like Grand Villa of Delray East. It passed in the state Senate on Thursday this week. What would this legislation mean for lawsuits like the one your firm is working on?
Well, sadly, I think it would cut the legs out of numerous lawsuits that could have a good deal of validity against facilities that were negligent. Basically, what it does is it grants full immunity to any facility that was negligent. And
it doesn't quite do that, counselor, right? I mean, what it does is it provides that's in the eye of the beholder, right? The legislation require a doctor to swear that they believe the injury or death related to a COVID-19 infection was the result of actions or lack of actions by a company such as a nursing home. That's one of the standards that this legislation puts in place. Do you have such a statement in your lawsuit?
We require those standards anyways in court. That doesn't change anything. So the fact that an expert is going to be required ultimately isn't changed. We would need that even now.
Spencer, you dropped out for just a moment there, Spencer. I apologize.
Sorry, my apologies. So I would have to have an expert to be able to testify as to that issue, even absent this legislation. That is not changing. What it does do
The legislation requires that testimony for a lawsuit to even proceed. It's not a matter of that testimony within the context of a hearing, but rather that testimony prior to a judge allowing a potential civil action to go forward.
Right. But again, in medical malpractice cases currently, even in those cases, it requires an expert pre-litigation. I have no problem and no qualms with that standard because we're going to need an expert anyways. What I have a problem with is taking that a step further and giving them immunity for negligence and raising the bar to an incredibly high level for citizens to judge these facilities.
And that high level, in your estimation, is this legal threshold of gross negligence, not
correct,
a preponderance of evidence, which is the
correct
hurdle.
I mean,
otherwise,
that's the standard. The standard of negligence in Florida has been in place for over 80 years now in the state of Florida. That is falling below the acceptable standard of care by a preponderance of the evidence. We don't require gross negligence in circumstances where someone has breached the standard of care. Raising that bar to that level requires something akin to manslaughter. And that's absolutely going to bar a number of cases where negligence has occurred.
Spencer, we have to leave the conversation there. We appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you,
Spencer,
for having
Kuvin,
me today.
Spencer Kuvin, attorney for the law firm representing the family of Sarah Schleider, who passed away from COVID-19. At a nursing home facility in Palm Beach County. Still to come, criminal charges against a former state senator accused of running a fake political campaign. That's coming up next on our special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. We're back on the special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. You can continue to make your donations through our program. More than 6,000 people voted for Alex Rodriguez last fall to be their state senator in a district that stretches from downtown Miami to Cutler Bay, from Coral Gables east to Key Biscayne. Jose Javier Rodriguez was the Democratic incumbent in that race. He lost by 32 votes. This week, prosecutors charged that Alex Rodriguez's campaign was fake, created and paid for by a former Republican state senator, Frank Artiez. Both men were charged in this ghost candidate scheme. Ana Ceballos and Samantha Gross are reporters with our news partner, the Miami Herald. They've been reporting on this since election night, for that matter. To both of you, thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us here. Ana, how did this scheme allegedly work?
Hi, thanks for having us. Well, the 25-page affidavit that was released yesterday was pretty detailed, and it was quite stunning to see just the extent to how it started with a 4 a.m. Facebook message from the former GOP senator to this parts dealer named Alex Rodriguez saying, "Hey, I need help with a, quote, political matter." And that matter ended up being related to offering him $50,000 to run as an independent in this very contentious, tight Senate race. And from there, you know, his involvement in launching the bid was pretty extensive. He told him to change his party affiliation from Republican to independent. He told him what paperwork to file. He told him, "You don't really need to do anything. Just keep your phone with you. And if, you know, election officials call you for confirmation on certain things, just make sure that you respond." So that's all laid out in this arrest warrant and affidavit that was filed in court yesterday. And it carries, you know, two felony charges, including making illegal contributions and the false swearing in, because he didn't even live in the district. And
right. Alex Rodriguez didn't live in the district that he allegedly was the straw candidate for. Samantha, how do these two guys know each other? How did they get connected?
So Frank Artiles and Alex Rodriguez had known each other for over 20 years, which is laid out in the warrant. And, you know, they have some mutual friends. They've known each other for a very long time. But according to the affidavit, they hadn't spoken for about a year, and they were kind of reintroduced through a third party, which isn't disclosed in the warrant who that was. So they kind of reconnected after, you know, a long time of knowing each other. And as Ana said, it all kind of started with a Facebook message in May where they rekindled their friendship.
Yeah, a real kind of lack of sophistication that's laid out in this, you know, the electronic messages, the text messages. I mean, one could argue not a whole lot of secrecy involved in these allegations.
Right. I mean, it was pretty stunning to see, you know, screenshots of text messages, repeated text messages saying, hey, you need to do this, instead of, you know, usually maybe you would have seen call logs, but this was explicit text messages and messages, as well as receipts for certain cash payments. And, you know, it's kind of stunning again to see that those things documented, because it gives prosecutors a pretty strong case.
So where did the money come from, this alleged payment or payments that totaled just shy of $50,000 that prosecutors say the former state senator Arthias paid Alex Rodriguez for being the ghost candidate?
The state attorney for Miami-Dade, Catherine Rundle, she said that it was unclear as to what the origins of the money were. So that's still an open investigation, which we're dying to find out, too. That's the question everyone's asking.
Yeah. And Samantha, not only the money that is alleged to have been paid to the fake candidate, but also the dollars that were used for the campaign itself, for some mailers and flyers that went out to voters, right?
Right. There were mailers that had gone out that were linked to political committees that were, you know, funded by money sources that we don't really know, you know, who was behind them. So that's another thing that we're going to be looking at. And, you know, we're interested to see what the state attorney's investigation finds when it comes to who was funding the money behind those, and obviously behind the payments to you know, Alex Rodriguez himself.
Yeah. So the two gentlemen named and arrested and charged here, Alex Rodriguez, the alleged straw candidate and the alleged strategist, I suppose, person who hatched this campaign, according to prosecutors, the former state Republican Senator Frank Arthias. What about the eventual winner in this actual election? What did prosecutors, Samantha, say about any knowledge of this plot by the Republican winner, now State Senator Elena Garcia?
Yeah, at her press conference yesterday, state attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle said that there was no evidence that Ileana Garcia knew of this scheme, you know, as they know right now. You know, in an interview on Wednesday, Senator Garcia told Ana that she didn't know who Arthias was until the reporting started to come out about his ties to her race and that she had never met him. So she also said that she had never been reached out to by prosecutors on this case either. So as of right now, there's no ties to Senator Garcia, and she's denying knowing anything about this or knowing, you know, even who Frank Arthias is.
Anna, what's been the reaction amongst Republican lawmakers in Tallahassee as they're in the middle of their legislative session?
Right, there's a lot going on in Tallahassee right now, and you know, this is, as Senate President Wilton Simpson put it, this is the topic of the day, at least as of yesterday and today. And the reaction has been, you know, they're trying to distance themselves from this. They're not really, they're saying that they had no idea that Arthias had been doing this, that they're just learning about these accusations, that they want to learn all the facts before they make any big comments or sweeping comments about what could happen next. They are just staying put, saying, you know, we just really never had any involvement with whatever he was trying to do independently on recruiting this no party candidate. And so it's, I guess the facts will, I mean, the facts were laid out in the affidavit. We'll see. Maybe they were trying to read it. We'll see what the further reaction is.
Certainly knowing about what's alleged in the warrant is one thing. But Anna, you reported months ago about how the former state senator on election night was in public kind of boasting, taking credit for the Democratic incumbent, Jose Javier Rodriguez, losing the Senate seat, right?
Right. Yeah. Sam and I spent, you know, I don't know, countless hours.
A long time.
Figure this out, because, you know, it was always a little suspicious, the candidacy of this no party candidate. And then, you know, we ended up finding out that on election night, Frank Arthias was in this, you know, party, election night party for another Senate race by Orlando, in the Orlando area. And he was very loud about bragging that, you know, he was involved in like planting this candidate, and everyone was a little bit confused. And so we reported that in December, and you know, the affidavit pretty much confirmed everything that was reported then.
So Sam, what are the next steps in regards to this particular case, especially against the former state senator?
This is still an open investigation. You know, I think prosecutors are going to be looking at some more leads, but, you know, we're kind of waiting to see what more they find. You know, in the meantime, Democrats are calling for, you know, Senator Garcia to resign. They're calling for a special election. These things, you know, there's a process to these things that need to be, you know, hashed out. But in the meantime, I think, you know, right now we're going to see what more of the prosecutors find, and see, you know, if there's going to be any sort of reaction from Senate leadership.
And in Tallahassee, has Senator Garcia responded at all to calls for her resignation or calls for a special election in this district?
Not yet. I mean, this just happened. What was it? An hour ago.
Just about. But I want to ask one question. We've only got 60 seconds left here, Anna, but I do want to get to this because lawmakers are considering legislation that would change Florida election law, making it more difficult to vote by mail. Any legislative response to the allegations of using straw candidates?
There is a Democrat filed bill that would address more so like that, not allowing independent candidates to run unless they have been independent, registered as independents for at least a year, which, for example, this Alex Rodriguez was not. He changed party affiliation days before. That hasn't been heard, and there's really no indication yet that it will be heard. We will see if it moves up forward. But
in the days and weeks ahead, time is ticking on the legislative session. Anna Ceballos and Samantha Gross, reporters with our news partner, the Miami Herald. Thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us here.
Thank you.
That'll do it for our special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. It is produced by Denise Royal and Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The WLRN director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter Mertz. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and above all, supporting public radio. Thanks for your support. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.